In 483, the Christians of the East split off from the Orthodox Church and became the Nestorian Church, which, as we've already noted, spread its missionaries far and wide throughout Central and Eastern Asia. This separation from Europe, since it freed the Christian bishops of the East from the rule of the Byzantine patriarchs, and so lifted from the Nestorian Church the suspicion of political disloyalty, led to a complete toleration of Christianity in Persia. With Chosroes I, 531 to 579, came a last period of Sassanid vigour. He was the contemporary and parallel of Justinian. He reformed taxation, restored the orthodox Zoroastrianism, extended his power into southern Arabia, Yemen, which he rescued from the rule of Abyssinian Christians, pushed his northern frontier into western Turkestan, and carried on a series of wars with Justinian. His reputation as an enlightened ruler stood so high that when Justinian closed the schools of Athens, the last Greek philosophers betook themselves to his court. They sought in him the philosopher king, that mirage which, as we've noted, Confucius and Plato had sought in their day. The philosophers found the atmosphere of orthodox Zoroastrianism even less to their taste than orthodox Christianity. And in 549, Chosroes had the kindness to insert a clause in an armistice with Justinian, permitting their return to Greece, and ensuring that they shouldn't be molested for their pagan philosophy or their transitory pro-Persian behaviour. It's in connection with Chosroes that we hear now of a new Hunnish people in Central Asia, the Turks, who are, we learn, first in alliance with him and then with Constantinople. Chosroes II, 590 to 628, the grandson of Chosroes I, experienced extraordinary fluctuations of fortune. At the outset of his career, he achieved astonishing successes against the Empire of Constantinople. Three times, in 608, 615, and 627, his armies reached Chalcedon, which is over against Constantinople. He took Antioch, Damascus, and Jerusalem in 614, and from Jerusalem he carried off a cross, said to be the true cross on which Jesus was crucified, to his capital, Ctesiphon. But some of this, or some other true cross, had already got to Rome. It had been brought from Jerusalem, it said, by the Empress Helena, the idealized and canonized mother of Constantine, a story for which Gibbon displayed small respect. In 619, Chosroes II conquered that facile country, Egypt. This career of conquest was at last arrested by the Emperor Heraclius in 610, who set about restoring the ruined military power of Constantinople. For some time, Heraclius avoided a great battle while he gathered his forces. He took the field in good earnest in 623. The Persians experienced a series of defeats culminating in the Battle of Nineveh in 627, but neither side had the strength for the complete defeat of the other. At the end of the struggle, there was still an undefeated Persian army upon the Bosphorus, although there were victorious Byzantine forces in Mesopotamia. In 628, Chosroes II was deposed and murdered by his son. An indecisive peace was concluded between the two exhausted empires a year or so later, restoring their old boundaries, and the true cross was sent back to Heraclius, who replaced it in Jerusalem with much pomp and ceremony. Third, so we give briefly the leading events in the history of the Persian as of the Byzantine Empire. What's more interesting for us and less easy to give are the changes that went on in the lives of the general population of those great empires during that time. The present writer can find little of a definite character about the great pestilences that we know swept the world in the 2nd and 6th centuries of this era. Certainly they depleted population, and probably they disorganized social order in these regions, just as much as we know they did in the Roman and Chinese empires. The late Sir Mark Sykes, whose untimely death in Paris during the influenza epidemic of 1919 was an irreparable loss to Great Britain, wrote in The Caliph's Last Heritage a vivid review of the general life of Nearer Asia during the period we're considering. in the opening centuries of the present era, he says, "The direction of military administration and imperial finance became entirely divorced in men's minds from practical government, and notwithstanding the vilest tyranny of sots, drunkards, tyrants, lunatics, savages, and abandoned women, who from time to time held the reins of government, Mesopotamia, Babylonia, and Syria contained enormous populations. Huge canals and dikes were kept in repair, and commerce and architecture flourished, in spite of a perpetual procession of hostile armies and a continual changing of the nationality of the governor. Each peasant's interest was centered in his ruling town. Each citizen's interest was in the progress and prosperity of his city. And the advent of an enemy's army may have sometimes been looked on even with satisfaction. If his victory was assured, and the payment of his contracts a matter of certainty. A raid from the north, on the other hand, must have been a matter for dread. Then the villagers had need to take refuge behind the walls of the cities, from whence they could descry the smoke which told of the wreck and damage caused by the nomads. So long, however, as the canals were not destroyed, and indeed they were built with such solidity and caution that their safety was assured, no irreparable damage could be effected. In Armenia and Pontus the condition of life was quite otherwise. These were mountain districts containing fierce tribes headed by powerful native nobility under recognized ruling kings, while in the valleys and plains the peaceful cultivator provided the necessary economic resources. Cilicia and Cappadocia were now thoroughly subject to Greek influence, and contained numerous wealthy and highly civilized towns, besides possessing a considerable merchant marine. Passing from Cilicia to the Hellespont, the whole Mediterranean coast was crowded with wealthy cities and Greek colonies, entirely cosmopolitan in thought and speech, with those municipal and local ambitions which seem natural to the Grecian character. The Grecian zone extended from Caria to the Bosphorus, and followed the coast as far as Sinope on the Black Sea, where it gradually faded away. Syria was broken up into a curious quilt-like pattern of principalities and municipal kingdoms, beginning with the almost barbarous states of Commagene and Edessa, Urfa, in the north. South of these stood Bambyse with its huge temples and priestly governors. Towards the coast, a dense population in villages and towns clustered around the independent cities of Antioch, Apamea, and Emesa, Homs. While out in the wilderness, the great Semitic merchant city of Palmyra was gaining wealth and greatness as the neutral trading ground between Parthia and Rome. Between the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon, we find, at the height of its glory, Heliopolis, Baalbek, the battered fragments of which even now command our admiration. Bending in towards Galilee, we find the wondrous cities of Gerasa and Philadelphia, Amman, connected by solid roads of masonry and furnished with gigantic aqueducts. Syria is still so rich in ruins and remains of the period that it's not difficult to picture to oneself the nature of its civilization. The arts of Greece, imported long before, had been developed into magnificence that bordered on vulgarity. The richness of ornamentation, the lavish expense, the flaunting wealth, all tell that the tastes of the voluptuous and artistic Semites were then as now. I've stood in the colonnades of Palmyra, and I've dined in the Hotel Cecil, and save that the latter is built of iron, daubed with sham wood, sham stucco, sham gold, sham velvet, and sham stone, the effect is identical. In Syria, there were slaves in sufficient quantity to make real buildings, and the artistic spirit is as debased as anything made by machinery. Over against the cities, the village folk must have dwelt pretty much as they do now, in houses of mud and dry stone wall, while out in the distant pastures the Bedouin tended their flocks in freedom under the rule of the Nabataean kings of their own race, or performed the office of guardians and agents of the great trading caravans. Beyond the herdsmen lay the parching deserts, which acted as the impenetrable barrier and defense of the Parthian Empire behind the Euphrates, where stood the great cities of Ctesiphon, Seleucia, Hatra, Nisibin, Haran, and hundreds more, whose very names are forgotten.